Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only...
Only
micro-broadcasting
only.
Radio station.
Only!
And now that we're back here in Chinatown, live, we can say that for sure, as we whip through the AM channels and...
Bam, 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 static, alone.
Static, static, boom, K-Chung, ka-chung.
That weird gospel station still around.
But oh,
that's
right.
That's not local. That's like sure. That's from like India or something, probably.
Mm-hmm. It's just hitting at the right angle of I don't know, whatever the atmosphere. Or something.
Yeah, the troposphere is reflecting it back to us.
Yeah. Oh, and I should mention that this is Nicholas Miller, with my
and
tireless co-host Steve Cato.
Whew. Hello. It is I, Steve Cato.
It's true. We are sorry that we missed last week, but we had a bit of a kerfuffle on the road.
I have a really good excuse.
On the way to the station. You want to tell our good listeners about that, Steve?
I got an fender bender.
Oof.
And that's it.
Is your Abogado Dominguez?
Firma Dominguez? I don't know yet. Actually, the funny part is that like it's just all up in the air. Like it happened, you know, after business hours on, you know, Wednesday, I guess, and then Thursday morning we started processing things with people, and then it just went into the hopper, and we don't know anything really. I don't know whether they'll let us. You know, whether we pay a lot, whether we pay a little, you know, no one was hurt, fortunately. So it's pretty
That's
chill.
Good.
Yeah. But it's, it was like, it wasn't even that jarring. It was just like a little jangling and I don't know. And then just fully annoying,
yeah.
You know, like it would be nice to just jump in the car and do stuff or run an errand. And now you shan't, you know. That's not
yeah,
on the table
it's
anymore.
It's totally opaque to how one proceeds.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just like their insurance is doing it or our insurance and they're going to communicate amongst. You know, what it really did for me was I was just like, oh, can you imagine working there? You know, like just being in insurance and every day some new, totally unremarkable, not compelling in any way fender bender comes on your desk and you have to call your opposite number at AAA insurance or Farmers or whatever the other insurance company is. And you have to be like, Jeff, it's me, Steve. Hey, so we got another one. We got a fender bender here, gray Prius. Yeah, yeah.
Or some days you probably call and you're like, oh, hey, can I talk to Jeff? No, sorry, you got Ted. Jeff's out today. You're like, oh, no. Not Ted.
Oh, fuck Ted. Yeah,
oh,
Ted
man,
sucks.
He's really tough.
Or I mean, you're all in the same business, so it's like just like a person whose voice is annoying to hear or something like that. It's like, hi, it's me, Ted! And you're like, oh, God, I hate it when it's Ted.
Right, or someone who speaks very quietly.
Yeah. I can't. Sorry, so you say we're going northbound through the intersection. I have the pictures here. It seems like the damage was extensive, but everyone's fine.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, anyway, so it's just like the idea that like these people just like have what, like an endless inbox of this like unremarkable garbage that they just like wake up every morning and like working from home, presumably just like grind through like endless phone calls with people from other insurance companies. Or like you save up four from like the same company and then call them and do all four, or like God, I don't know, you know. It seems like it, I guess dentists are the profession that has the highest suicide rate, but
really,
geez, it sounds apparently I guess it's because everyone's terrified of you.
It's true. I don't know anyone who enjoys going to the dentist other than my father.
Yeah, I don't mind it, actually, I have to be honest. And
oh,
I enjoy
like
being
okay.
I enjoy a cleaning.
Yeah, it feels good afterwards.
Yeah. And to be fair, I have had very low I've had like a lot of surgery and stuff because I've had like a weird mouth my whole life. But there's been like nothing to, you can't do anything about it. You know what I mean? Like there's no, you know, like it's not like I could have avoided it. So I might as well just like relax and let it wash over me. You
sure.
know?
I just can't stand all the shaming and guilting at the dentist. You know?
Oh, where they're just like, tut, tut, tut. You should have flossed more. Like, things
yeah.
like that.
They're like, do you brush every day? Yes, I do the thing. Well, you don't do a good enough job. Okay, you want to come over and do it every day?
Oh. Well, see, I guess maybe my thing is that I have done such a good job.
Oh, well, there you go.
And that all my problems are just like literally insane. They're like, well, you're growing a second set of teeth on the top palate.
Shark's teeth.
Yeah, have you been brushing? You certainly have. You've brushed so well that you've grown a whole second set of teeth.
Yeah. Your teeth have been bragging to other teeth, and so they've migrated.
Yeah, they've been leaving other people's heads and joining your head.
Yeah, yeah. The tooth fairy is depositing teeth in your mouth in the
doing
evening.
Pickups in the neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, because every tooth deserves a good home. So we hear that Steve Cato provides such a great home that we're going to deposit more teeth in the roof of your mouth.
Yeah. So like all my problems are just like just raw, personal, real straightforward shit where it's just like, you know, like you grew too many teeth. You're a freak. So it's like, then they're like, yeah, 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 you're brushing. That's great. Keep up the good work.
I did the best time I had a dentist was in West Texas, and I thought for I hadn't been in a number of years, which is my MO, and I thought for sure, you know, they'd say you have cavities and this or that, but she said that I was looking tip top, and I thought, wow, you're my favorite dentist ever. And then, you know, the assistant came in and said, oh, you know, Susan's up next or something. And it became clear through the course of their conversation that the next patient, Susan, was a horse.
Wow.
And so like, you know, the little divots and future cavities I had probably seemed like nothing to this dentist who deals with horses' teeth and horse.
Yeah, which are much bigger.
And yeah, so and they don't brush. Scale. You know, they don't brush.
Yeah.
I guess they don't eat ice cream either. Probably not.
Sugar cubes.
Yeah, exactly. Salt licks. So I thought, well, I should try and find a dentist here in Pasadena that also handles farm animals.
That shouldn't be too hard. I mean, there's a lot of horse areas.
Yeah, and Altadena seems very horse.
Yeah, location.
Horsey.
Yeah. Yeah, you've got a lot of horse dentists to compare yourself to. That is such a great West Texas thing, though, where you're just like, so what's going on here? And you're like, well, I also do horses. Like, I do all the teeth in this community, regardless of species. Like, that's great.
Yeah, my favorite story like that about West Texas is my friend Tim, when he moved there, it's a long drive to get there, and he was having trouble with his tires. I think he had a flat or something in the next town over before he arrived. And so he pulled over to like the local mechanic and got his tire replaced. And then halfway from Alpine, Texas to Marfa, Texas, the wheel fell off his car. They hadn't bolted it back on.
Fuck.
And so he called them, and they were very apologetic, and they drove out, and they put his car on the truck and then drove him back to Alpine to put a new tire on.
Uh-huh.
And the guy felt so bad that he took him into the basement where the mechanics make their own moonshine and was like, pick any jug you want.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, so he got his tire replaced and got a free jug of moonshine.
That's great. And it's like, if the only thing would be better if it was also a dentist.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pick any jug you want, have a few swigs, and then I'm just going and raw dogging with the drill. Just
right.
Like,
right.
Just here's a strap you can bite.
a tire.
Yeah, just
a
just
bit of tire.
Clench this piece of tire rubber in your hand really tightly and have a swig of this while I go in there and fix your teeth.
Right. Well,
that rules.
I apologize to our audience if we're triggering anyone with all this dentist talk, but we can assure you that we have some particularly relaxing talking tonight. Get you right in the mood.
If this freaked you out, you will calm down immediately.
Exactly. Yeah, we know many of you have felt motivational woes during this lockdown, and it's time to get inspired, calm down, focus, get back to this, all these creative industries we participate in.
Yeah.
So tonight we have the one, the only, Yoji Yamamoto.
Woo!
My main focusing coming in Paris was just opening tiny shop, but there happened something because I was not only one. The other designer, one more designer, did the same thing. So, for European people, it was like a new movement arrived, or a new army arrived. I think they accepted in that way. So I didn't mean it, I just wanted to open a tiny shop. I have a double feeling. Maybe I have changed as something else, even minor change. But same time, I feel I couldn't change anything at all. As you know, the market in the world became like fast, 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 cheap, 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 sexy, sexy, sexy. This is very far from me. In that meaning, I couldn't change anything. I'm strongly believing in craftsmanship. I mean, human's hand. And for example, when I stick on Japanese craftsmanship for weaving, for sewing, for cutting, maybe I'm touching a little bit a culture of human being, human fingers, which I believe in strongly. Mentally, I'm very far from mass production. So, the sort of meaning of American success. I'm not very successful designer. In America, success means fame and money. I think myself may be famous in Europe. But money, I don't know. For me, comfortable profit is enough to keep on going. Designing men's clothing is very difficult for me. because I don't like too much fashionable men. Do you like fashionable men? Very trendy, perfect fashion. So I think my role about men's designing is that let's be easy from trend. Let's take it easy from trend. I'm the customer of my men's creation. They are not wearing tie, not businessmen. Almost they are working as a free something. In that case, they can look a little strange and funny. Designing men's is quite limited because we have only shirt and jacket and pants. That's it. So we have to put some irony or joke or funny message. But for women, spiritually or philosophically, it's the same. Let's be out. But women's body is, for me, like a desert, and blowing the wind, and the mountain of sand is always changing. So I can have so many imagination on women's body because it is always changing. Compared to women's body, men's body is already promised. We can only change sizes or length, width, that's it. But designing women's clothing is like a journey. And I think that being a strong designer for women's designer is more important than being a strong designer for men. Historically. I think the reason is that designing clothing for women, we have no room. everything is possible. Sometimes I feel too free. It's very hard. Freedom and duty is like a coin, service and back. And there's always no answer forever. I have still people who understand my thinking and buy my clothing. And I have to answer to them. And same time, if I say this sounds maybe too arrogant, but let me say, beautiful things are disappearing every day. I want to keep it back. I want to say, don't go too much, too far, too easy. Take it easy. I think this is my role. I think it's like thinking about the earth go to hell. We can't stop. Do you think we can stop? I don't think so. In my heart, I'm always saying, go to hell. I don't care. Very roughly, if we choose two big responsibilities, one side is our government people, governor. They can change the way of going of people. And one side is artist. They can also change, or they can also make people think, make bigger people doubt what's going on. But actually, I'm not pessimist, but I'm not believing both of them. Because we went too far. So at least, as like a very old man, I'm saying that, hey man, beautiful things are disappearing every day. Look at them, keep at them. Be careful. Don't go too fast. Look back. This is like an old man's mumbling.
Well, you've always looked back, haven't you, really?
Yeah. Look back. You gave me a chance to give me my dream, because my dream from childhood was being a painter. Now you gave me a chance, so I started from Dessen, croquis. Go back to a real painter or real drawer. You need exercise, practice a lot. It's not so easy. So I need to create time to exercise, to practice drawing and painting. So, actually, I have a chance, which you gave me, but I'll be so busy. Happily. I'm often asked, what is gorgeous for you? Then I answer, I don't care too much about the property, like a big house, private jet, big castle. I'm not interested in them at all. My most gorgeous moment is creating, growing. So in that meaning, I'm very lucky. And a happy man.
Wow. I feel better already.
Yeah.
My teeth feel better too.
Yeah. I maybe it's a common thing, but I like how he was just like, I'm not a very successful designer because normal people can't dress like this.
Yeah.
And like, I never thought of it that way. Like, I didn't really think that was the point of fashion in a way. Like, you were like, well, people who look really good aren't like normal people in the first place.
That's true. Yeah. These outfits are rarely practical. Although, yeah, I don't think of his clothes as being particularly impractical.
No, but I think he was like sort of, there's also this like sort of idea that like, you know, like a Japanese salaryman or something like that couldn't dress this way to work.
Sure. Although I found like some fashion entry online a couple months ago of like, Japanese city workers, like the ones that fix the rail cars and the electrical and stuff like that, and they wear like marvelously big baggy wide pants.
Yeah, that's like a standard Japanese work pant.
Yeah, which seems somewhat impractical. I don't know. I asked a Japanese friend of mine, and he said that it has to do with like extending your senses, like you can feel more. You know, if your pants are 30 inches wide or whatever.
Well, I think part of it as well is that like the work culture is like construction in Japan, for example, like a construction shoe is like not a heavy boot.
Mm-hmm.
And so like you're expected to be more personally do more personal gymnastics.
Sure. Be a bit more agile.
To get around to, yeah. So it's like, whereas like the idea of like an American working garment is just like pants that literally like stand up on their own.
Yeah, just like crunch through the whole job.
Yeah, and you wear big boots, and if anything like falls on your foot, or you know, like you step on something, you're fine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if like a nail gun gets shot at your leg, like it just bounces off of the like four layers of duck canvas. You know that you're, you know, like stuff like it, honestly
steel-toed
true, right?
Boot.
It's like steel-toed boot, and like, you know, I think other versions of construction are have different expectations, you know, and they're just sort of like, oh no, you know, like there shouldn't be nails in the ground for you to step on. The nail should be in the building.
Right. Exactly. Keep the nails.
Don't fuck up.
Also, we don't have steel, so let's the nails are precious.
Yeah. Well, Japan actually has all the steel.
Oh, I thought that it's was part of the idea of, or people always explain the intricate joinery, wood joinery, from the lack of.
Oh, I mean, that's true. That it's seen as like cool to not use fasteners.
I see.
But no, like that's why they make swords and stuff.
No, oh, yeah, true.
They're like great at steel, and I mean they don't have many resources, which is why they did such fervent colonization in Asia. At the beginning of the 20th century, because they were like, well, we don't have that many resources here because we're a tiny country, but you know, we'll certainly take everything we can from Korea or whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, they had huge shipyards too. Like Japan has these, I don't know if they still do, but until sort of the 80s, they had these giant shipyards and they made many kinds of boats and, you know, all this other stuff. So they have like lots of heavy manufacturing and giant cranes and stuff and all of that kind of stuff. But it's more like they have steel, but you just shouldn't drop it.
So yeah.
Keep your toes out of there, you know,
right.
Like you're wearing slippers on the job. Don't drop the steel on your foot.
Sure.
Yeah, that would be stupid.
It's a good way to go about things.
I'm of two minds, because like I've definitely like stubbed my toe on the odd thing and wished that I hadn't been wearing like essentially like aqua socks everywhere, which is my curse. But then, you know, similarly, I also identify. I'm like, oh yeah, I wear a similar kind of almost non-shoe all the time because I
try to do things carefully.
Yeah, yeah. Or you might as well. Can't hurt. You know,
no, it never does.
Yeah, what were your favorite bits?
I found the whole bit about gender puzzling. But I guess, I guess, you know,
like women change so much and men stay the same?
Or just that, you know, Yoji is still considered very radical to arriving in Paris in the 90s, and this kind of very pared down and subdued looks in the face of people like, you know, Jean-Paul Gaultier and this extreme extravagance of the 80s. But that, you know, he just accepts that menswear is neutral. You know, menswear is the kind of stationary ground, and then womenswear is where the designer plays.
Yeah.
I guess I found that surprising that he was so steadied in that viewpoint, which obviously is being broken down by so many designers these days.
Right.
Even here in LA, 69, for example.
Well, although like also very restrained, you know, I would argue, you know, like extremely, what's the word I'm thinking of? Like in some ways, like very conservative, I guess, you know, like not, extremely, you know, it's not like Gaultier or something like that, I guess. It's not like, you know, like a million colors and like even like the way that like flesh is exposed in a 69 thing is extremely sort of like, you see they on the front, it looks like it's like an extremely high waisted frumpy jean, but it has no back.
Yeah.
Aha.
You could urinate anywhere.
You can just take a poop.
Right.
But then like, so what kind of, you know, it's like, so like it's still operating from like a 50% Seinfeld pant sort of domain, or like a Yoji Yamamoto on the ranch sort of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting. Like from sort of like an idea of like a universal masculine blank gender to just being like, how about blank gender? And you're like, it's kind of the same, no?
Yeah, I wonder, like, you know, because with something I only recently discovered about Yoji is that I always knew that he and Rei Kawakubo showed up in Paris at the same time.
Yeah.
You know, and really shook things up. But I didn't know that they went together and that they were partners for a decade.
Like sexual partners.
Yeah, they lived together. They're both...
that's got to be quite the house.
Yeah, and I found another interview where he talked about it, and he said that, you know, she was... that they never discussed work with each other, that they hid their collections from each other.
That's cool.
Yeah, I suppose so.
I kind of like that. I mean, I feel like I kind of do that with my spouse.
Yeah.
The only reason to talk about it would be to be like, I have to go work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And be like, okay, go work on it, you know?
Right.
But then, like... You wouldn't like be like, I mean, a little bit, but I like to not talk about it.
Sure.
I understand that. I see where he's coming from.
Yeah. So I don't know, I guess, and then he developed into, or he just really focused on women's wear and his design, and she focused on, changing the image of the woman.
Right. Huh. The woman.
Women.
There's only one.
Right.
Yeah, I didn't know that either. That's cool. It's wild that they were both so despite his protestations otherwise, that he was like both so extraordinarily successful.
True. True.
You know? What a couple.
She seems more successful than him at this point, but they franchised that work a bit differently.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think I guess there is sort of like a mass market Yoji.
I don't think. Well, there's one, the Adidas thing, Y3 or Y's,
yeah,
or whatever it's called.
And there's like Pleats Please, you know, sort of like more accessible.
That's Issey Miyake.
So I fucked up. But
same thing. He doesn't really get talked about as much. I don't know.
There was a Yoji suiting thing too that was like kind of more accessible for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I feel like there's yeah, I don't know. I feel like I when I was in Seattle, and they have that one really fancy store that carries all this stuff, and you wonder for whom, because literally no one in Seattle dresses this way.
Sure.
You know, it wasn't, I don't know, like the, yeah, I guess like the Comme des Garçons stuff was like the cheapest stuff in the store.
Well, you also, if you go to stores like that, it's funny because you see like the same garments stay on the rack for months and months.
Yeah.
Because I don't imagine they have like 30 of this $6,000 shirt or whatever. But
no, yeah.
Like part of the idea of the price is the scarcity of it. I mean, perhaps that's false, but that's at least how I understand couture.
Yeah, well, and also just that, like, literally, at least in Seattle, you know, no one is buying it.
Yeah, it's just true. Like,
it just sits there forever, like a dinosaur DNA in a mosquito cast in amber, and eventually, from the ruins of the Chaz. People will find it eventually in the future and be like, wow, people in Seattle really dressed cool, huh? And the answer will be no. There was just one cool store here. Yeah, I don't know. I feel like the Comme des Garçons sort of mass market thing really exploded in recent years too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the heart smiley face thing.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, there's I don't think those same sort of partnership deals have been inked for Yoji, which I don't think seems to bother him very much based on the interview we just heard.
No, Not at all.
I think he's fine without having a streetwear line.
That is a funny thing. I wonder, it doesn't seem like this happens with artists, but perhaps it does happen to artists that run their studios like fashion houses, which there certainly are. But there seems to always be this moment of tension in a successful fashion designer's career where they no longer are the lead designer of their own fashion house. Like people always, there's a moment where Margiela left his own, Maison Margiela, and people always, you know, collectors always talk about, you know, that the garments after such and such a date are no good because Rei Kawakubo is not involved anymore.
Yeah.
But she is still involved in the highly exclusive, expensive line, et cetera, or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's a funny, it seems like a peculiar thing to fashion where they get gobbled up and they can no longer run their own thing.
Well, or to be fair, like it just extends beyond like even like a human lifespan.
Sure.
Or like a full career, you know, like, and like the house, like in the feudal sense, has this meaning outside of, you know, the individual life of like Coco Chanel or whatever, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Like it's still like, I think that would be a really great move for art. Actually,
yeah, like you know, like 30 years from now, Jeff Koons' studio is still making work, just under the under the guidance of Steve Cato or something.
Yeah, like the new director of Koons' studio is so and so, and you know, House Michael Snow has put in another structural film. Well, I think it would make art history easy.
Maison Rashid Johnson.
Yeah, Maison Rashid Johnson. You know, like, because you would just know where to look. You'd be like, where's the... Like, there wouldn't be new structural filmmakers. It'd just be, like, the new director. Or maybe you would, you know, do your own collection for a little while. And then, you know, you would be, like, picked to be the new director of... So you would keep your side gig, you know, and then you would still... You'd still do, you know, a few shows for Studio Steve Cato. On the side, but you would be like the director of, you know, Maison Morgan Fisher, and make like one big name structural film a year.
Right. It seems tough. Like, you know, you read these stories about, like so many of these big name designers, especially from the '90s are always talked about as like they were standouts in their design programs. But you wonder today, like what, you know, if you're going to fit them in downtown LA, how does one stand out? It's like, oh, they slash the garments. You're like, well, that's not exactly new. They made, I don't know, they used military wear in finer fabrics. You're like, okay. But I guess the last big one to come out was Virgil Abloh, right? With the quotation marks.
Yeah. Which is just like, there is screen printing.
Yeah, and like 90s deconstruction,
French like deconstruction art.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, well, there you have it.
Yeah, I guess I don't want to sound like a downer, but I am not. I don't love the Virgil Abloh.
Oh yeah, I don't
move.
It doesn't make a lot of sense to me either.
I don't like love the party. I think it's like. Like there are also like Jenny Holzer Uniqlo t-shirts. You know what I mean? Like it's like there have been for a while. Like it's not, you know, you can go to the mall and they can put anything funny on a shirt.
True.
Like it's not, my mind's not blown. There's not like, you know, like, oh, look, you made men into a new weird shape or something.
Was
like,
was it kind of one of the first full embraces of high-end streetwear? I don't know that history so well.
I feel like that's like a transitional moment, right? Where like streetwear won.
Right. For menswear at least.
Yeah. Yeah. Like it like just came right over and like took over.
Mm-hmm.
And to much outcry from the, you know, from people who wanted the great houses to, you know, have some sort of other meaning.
Sure.
But yeah, it is. Well, yeah, that would be another really cool thing is that, like, you know, Maison, I don't know who the fuck, Maison Fishley and Weiss could start making something completely unofficially in Vice for a little while. You know, mm-hmm. like they had a weird phase where they were under the directorship of like, you know, a neo-expressionist painter or something. And they just made like a bunch of like really ugly Abex paintings for a little while.
Oh,
and
yeah.
then like, then there was a return to tradition where someone else took photographs of airports. You know, for a little while, and made like kind of cute sculptures of moderate size.
Cute sculptures of moderate size.
Maisel Sturdivant just fully just began making super earnest original work for a little while
yeah.
before returning to like sarcastic copy, you know, sort of appropriationalism.
Right. I mean, I saw that traveling Dior show that was hung by creative director. Like, you know,
yeah.
so it'd be like, this is when Dior was in charge. This is when Raf Simons was in charge.
Yeah, yeah.
That was, it'd be fun to see art shows like that.
Yeah, by like studio director.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and to be fair, I think that's actually like a way that I would hope that contemporary art would be historicized. You know, like I would really love for... because I think it's probably true that things work differently, you know, and things come out differently under different studio directors.
Yeah.
So I think it would be like worth it to be like, oh, so then, you know, what happened when there was like the big shakeup at Maison Jonas Wood or whatever, you know, how did things change? What, you know, or like people who have had one assistant for an extremely long time, you know, like what Alan Sekula had like the same one assistant for like 10 years or something.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And so like that person's obviously a really big part of how things go, you mm-hmm. know, like mm-hmm. however you want to think about it. So, yeah, I wonder. And yeah, so I don't know. I think it would be, especially since like what, like a big studio is itself like such an organization unto itself.
Sure.
That it would be like great for historians to take that into account.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Oh my God. Could you imagine if they broke down like a studio, like Laura Owens's, you know, sort of like the way that they would do fashion? It'd be great.
I mean, they really should anyway. What was it? Our former guest, Maria Bamford, was pointing that out, that these
yeah.
big studios, I mean, it should just, at least like a film, have a credits.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Which, like, to be fair, we make fun of Doug Aitken a lot because the work is so bad.
Right,
but
he
at
does
least
do that.
He does do credits, yeah. At least he does provide sort of like complete documentation. Unfortunately, it's for the wrong reasons, right? It's like because the pretext of being like wants the glamour of being a filmmaker, but, you know... wants the cachet of being the intellectual cachet of being a fine artist, I guess. I don't know. It's like neither one nor the other.
Different funding streams, I suppose.
Yeah. I saw Southland Tales again the other day.
How was that?
Fucking awesome. just speaking of cinema that doesn't know what it's doing, you know, what position it wants to assume. You've seen that movie before, right?
I have not.
Oh, I recommend it. You should.
Southland?
Southland Tales. It's one of the first films. It's the guy who did Donnie Darko. He did
okay.
three feature films. He did Donnie Darko, which made him, you know, Hollywood was like, wow, we're impressed. This kid made this great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the second movie he makes is Southland Tales. And he gets an incredible budget. It stars like a pile of stars, you know, like Justin Timberlake, The Rock, Sarah
wow.
Michelle Gellar.
The Rock.
Seth Rogen, John LaRoquette, Wallace Shawn, oh, talking show favorite Wallace Shawn.
I'm in.
And like one, just like literally jillions of actors, huge cast. John Lovitz. Oh, John Lovitz is amazing. John Lovitz plays like a psychotic, ultra dangerous cop, which
okay,
is just
this
nuts.
Looks incredible.
Yeah. And then, the movie is almost entirely incoherent. It's 3 hours long. It's great. It literally is like extremely prescient. It tells you everything you need to know about the world we live in today. And then Hollywood does not know what to do with this. And then he makes The Box like 10 years later. Starring Cameron Diaz.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. So just like a man who really put it all in, you know, like when Hollywood, you do your one little thing and Hollywood says like, oh, we're going to take a chance on you. You seem like a interesting and useful young man.
Profitable.
For our purposes. Yeah. We're going to invest in you, and you just take that money and you just run.
Yeah.
You just go totally nuts. And make like the weirdest Iraq war movie. But yeah, I recommend it very highly, even though it does sort of lose steam after the halfway point. Yeah, there's another prominent feature is that there's a neo-Marxist underground causing social unrest, which is like just amazing. You know, it's like a movie where there's actually like an actual Antifa. It's great. I cannot recommend it. And we're so used to seeing The Rock in his current form, where he is like he's good at being in movies,
mm-hmm.
and he's broadly speaking like egg shaped. You know, he's like this extremely. Everything is equidistant from every other part of The Rock. You know, his arm is like the size of your waist.
Right.
You know, like he's every single part of him is just like extremely full of body mass.
Yeah.
And this is like a young Rock where he is like, he has a discernible neck. He's got a waist that's different from his shoulders. His arms are a reasonable size. And he's not good at acting yet.
Okay.
It's great.
His shtick now, which is fantastic, is the preposterously strong nice guy.
Yeah.
Like he's like
I'm a nice guy.
Yeah, I could tear you limb from limb, but I just want to be a good dad.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And he does the eyebrow thing.
Yeah.
From his wrestling days, and then he's just like, "Oh, I'm broadly speaking a sphere, but it's all muscle."
Right.
Yeah. It's cool. We've been watching the Fast and the Furious movies, and so I was just like, let's just take a little detour into some deep The Rock lore, because he's in that series now. But you know, that's the Rock, the modern Rock that we're talking about. You know, he's like, in the first movie where The Rock faces off against Vin Diesel before aligning himself with Vin Diesel, in later movies, the difference between the two of them are that like they're both these like extremely muscular, bald men. But one of them is oiled up, which is The Rock,
mm-hmm.
all the time. So one of them's just moist and one of them's dry. And it's sort of like I think Meredith did like a sort of Levi Strauss style analysis of like the wet and the dry in Fast Furious
right.
6 or whatever. But yeah, no, it's just
one of the oldest antagonisms in Western culture
between the wet and the dry.
Right. Right.
Yeah. It's also, it's visible in things like cat foods and other parts of, our world system.
Jesus parting the sea, you know,
that was Moses.
Oh, sorry.
yeah. And yeah, what you feed the cat in the morning and what you feed the cat in the night. yeah, absolutely. Anywho,
our viewers have their work cut out for them with all
yeah.
of these film recommendations.
Yoji, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Yoji. Thanks for calming us all down during these difficult times.
Yeah,
essential work, I'd say.
Indeed, thank you so much.
Good morning, Chinatown.
Bye.